You're listening to Avacynt on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into government-driven markets.
With Avacynt's On the Record podcast, I'm August Cole, writer-in-residence. The Trump administration intends to reshape U.S. military relationships in Europe and Asia to shift the cost of Western collective security to America's allies. While the extent and pace of these changes remains to be determined, Avacynt's latest report explores the impact of an America First defense strategy. To discuss the implications for Europe, we're joined by Jessica DiPaolo, market analyst, Michael Barber, analysis manager, Allison Gibbs, a senior market analyst, and Chris Yee Paulson, a senior market analyst. Thanks for joining us. So Allison, what is the position of European nations relative to other regions if the U.S. backs off from its forward presence defense commitments?
Yeah, so we looked at both Asia and Europe for this paper, and the biggest difference that you'll see is that the Asia alliance with the U.S. is set up in a much more asymmetric nature. It's this U.S. hub and spoke model. The U.S. is in the middle and has individual alliances with the different Asian countries. Europe is very different from that. The U.S. is embedded in the security architecture through the NATO alliance. So the U.S. is very much a part of the architecture, but it's not the only player. So you have this broader security framework for Europe to lean on. If the U.S. were to shift away or shift in a different direction, Europe would still have this alliance structure in place. It's not going to be every country suddenly having to go all on its own.
Which European nations have come to depend the most on America's security architecture, and what do they have to lose potentially?
France is the leader in the clubhouse with a 9 out of 10 in our analysis, boosted by 10s in budget availability, political will, and industrial base. So I'll walk through those three, and you can read the rest for yourselves. So first, looking at the French budget. The Ministry of Defense budget in France is the second largest in Europe, behind only the UK. It is projected to reach nearly $48 billion in 2017 and to grow at about 1.4% per year through 2022. So as France prioritizes new platform procurement and some internal safety measures, it will spend over 32% of its defense budget on investment accounts, so procurement and R&D. And including all measures of defense spending, France spends nearly 1.9% of total GDP on defense and ranks among the most significant contributors to NATO. And secondly, political will, so another 10 out of 10 for us. In May, as pretty much everybody knows, France will elect a new president, in which promises to be one of the most dramatic elections in our recent history. But for all candidates, French political support for a robust defense budget remains pretty strong. So many of the same factors that unfortunately impact France's threat environment score will also drive political and public support for a pretty large defense budget and its continued growth into the future. And finally, industrial base, so our final 10 out of 10 for France. The French industrial base is very strong. So in our analysis, we identified about 82% of total contract value from 2012 to 2016 coming from French suppliers, and another 11.6% coming from neighboring European countries. So a lesser U.S. presence in France and in Europe could actually be a boon for the French industry, as other countries could rely on the French industrial base to help fill their own gaps. So overall, our leader in the clubhouse is France. And just as a quick summary, sort of in lieu of U.S. support in priority areas like long-range strike, ISR surveillance, airlift transport aircraft, which is something that you'll see across all European nations as we continue this analysis, France is pretty well positioned to expand its already prominent domestic industry and leverage existing relationships with regional allies that they already have.
So Jessica, let's look at the lowest ranked countries. Who's there? What might they do? And what is industry's role and what's next?
So Poland is at the bottom of the class due to a high threat posed by Russia following the annexation of Crimea in 2014, and then also recently the movement of Iskander missiles in Kaliningrad in late 2016, which borders Poland, in addition to low scores in both the U.S. presence category and domestic industrial base. However, Poland is one of the few NATO countries to spend 2% of their overall GDP on defense, and is showing a strong defense growth of 5.4% over the next 5 years. Poland has also been actively developing their defense industrial base, but continues to rely pretty heavily on foreign firms for many of the know-hows. Russia is also viewed as a major threat to both the government and the general public, so increases in defense expenditures related to deterring Russia would certainly receive support, but we wouldn't expect substantial increases over the next few years, because the defense budget is also competing with other priorities, such as social priorities that the Law and Justice Party promised to the general public.
So, Mike, if you're running a U.S. prime or on its board, what are some of the key takeaways from this analysis?
So we focused on a couple things here. First, it's important to understand that while existing relationships will likely continue, European industry is poised to take advantage of many regional capability gaps. And frankly, they are also the most aware of them. So, and in this hypothetical era where European to European alliances and relationships will be particularly valued, they will find enthusiastic customers domestically and within the wider region. However, a diminished U.S. presence will certainly leave some opportunities available for U.S. primes. So speaking on France, which is, again, our most prepared country by our metrics, this will be a few areas. One, ISR, and this is probably the best shot for U.S. suppliers, enablers, tankers, airlift, etc., for overseas operations especially, and intelligence gathering and support. So this is domestically in France, but this is also overseas in Africa, for example.
What about for European defense executives? Is America First good news or bad news?
Yeah, so going off of what Mike mentioned, it's largely good news. You have a lot of these countries that are already procuring European-made platforms and equipment. And what you'll see then is that they will need more of those things in order to fill these capability gaps. So European companies really have the chance to up the number of orders they receive and the number of things that they can produce. The other piece that you may see happen is that there will be a stronger impetus with an American First policy for European countries to not just start a lot of development projects that then never go into production. This might actually push European countries to go all the way with things like the MALE 2020 program and things of that nature.
So could this be a net positive for the European industrial base if the region's ministries need to rely on their own capabilities?
So as Allison mentioned, overall, I think this is a positive thing, but there's a little bit of nuance to it. It sort of depends on how you define net positive. Ministries will likely see more contracts going to their home markets. However, in certain market areas, particularly like ISR, so if the UK is a great example, their fleet is entirely American built. They run a combination of Northrop E3Ds and Raytheon Sentinels that are due to retire in the next 5-10 years. So, but that said, in these particular sectors, because there's almost an oligopoly brought on by American dominance, you're going to see greater competition from European suppliers within these sectors. Now, this is a good thing because there's more contracts going to be going, but this could be a net positive for end consumers because potential prices can decrease. That said, because of the competition and potential price decreases, you might see lower profits for certain companies.
So will this become more of a nation-by-nation approach to filling capability gaps, or could it look more institutional like EU versus NATO?
So it's a good question, and it remains to be seen. Look, Europe has been talking about joint procurement and pooling and sharing forever. This is certainly not something new, but this America First shift, or the potential for that shift, is really a forcing mechanism that hasn't been there previously. So we've seen political statements about needing to do more joint procurements, about needing to pool and share more, but I think we're beginning to see more projects that actually have teeth. One example, you have the European tanker project that's going to be procuring up to 8 A330 tankers, and you're starting to see more countries join that because there is this forcing mechanism. It's a gap that they recognize. It's something they need to do something about, and there's a real possibility that they might not have access to American enablers, to American things to do those sorts of things. So I think we will see a shift towards more multilateral solutions. Having said that, there's always going to still be projects that will be done on a nation-by-nation basis. So to what extent remains to be seen.
Are there any gaps from an America First policy that can be quickly filled domestically? Or does the European theater look like there will be an enduring U.S. defense industrial connection, even if its NATO forward deployed presence diminishes?
In the near term, European defense suppliers will be hard-pressed to ramp up their domestic production quick enough to cover some of the gaps left by American suppliers. ISR is an example we've touched on. That said, over time, European industry will likely be able to create more domestic solutions, most likely multilateral solutions. But in the beginning, I think we're going to still see some levels of connections to the American suppliers, and then that will likely change as time goes on.
Well, the threat environment regionally is Russia-driven. So how does the pace of Russian modernization impact the gap analysis? In other words, what Russian forces can do today is going to be very different 5 years from now as they upgrade and invest and also hone their operational concepts in Syria and Ukraine.
Sure. Well, looking at this from Poland's perspective, this certainly adds pressure to the country to continue building on their industrial capabilities and fulfill requirements that have been continuously delayed, such as their Wisla air defense program, the multi-role helicopter, and several large naval contracts. Poland in 2016 made the announcement that they were going to finalize a deal for the Wisla air defense program, but as of now, they're still considering between the Patriot system and MEADS, and will hopefully make a decision this year instead. With regards to Poland's naval contracts, their Orca-class submarine and procurement of patrol vessels and corvettes were all delayed by 2 years after a review of major defense contracts by the Law and Justice Party. And then, of course, there was the cancellation of the $3.5 billion Caracal deal with Airbus in late 2016 to procure 50 helicopters. But instead, the country is now only procuring 16. So as Russia continues to modernize, Poland will have to finalize their decisions for these major programs in the immediate terms so that they don't fall behind on readiness.
With Avasense on the Record podcast, I'm August Cole. And to read more on the international markets forecast, go to avasense.com.
You've been listening to Avasant on the Record. To learn more about Avasant, go to avasant.com or follow us on Twitter @Avasant.